When we look back at the early days of the United States, before the Civil War, a lot of the focus on racial injustice is on the slave-owning states of the southern and central parts of the country. But our next guests say we tend to overlook another big part of the story, racial violence in the northern states, with mob attacks on black communities, often with the cooperation of political leaders. They say these violent attacks resemble the better-known Tulsa, Oklahoma massacre of 1921, and that we need to confront these stories for a better understanding of our history. Our guest wrote about how these riots were more common in the 19th century than we remember in a piece for the National Museum of American History's blog. It's titled Many Tulsa Massacres, How the Myth of a Liberal North Erases a Long History of White Violence. Christy Clark Pujara is an associate professor of history in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison. She's the author of Dark Work, The Business of Slavery in Rhode Island. Her current project is Black on the Midwestern Frontier, From Slavery to Suffrage in the Wisconsin Territory, 1725 to 1868. Christy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Annalisa Cox, historian of racism in 19th century America, currently a non-resident fellow at Harvard's Hutchins Center for African and African-American Research. She's the author of the book Bone and Sinew of the Land, America's Forgotten Black Pioneers and the Struggle for Equality. Annalisa, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Well, Christy, how common was this type of violence in the North in the early days of the United States before the Civil War?
It was incredibly common. By one historian's count, just in a few year period between 1834 and 1836, he counted something like 46 mob attacks against African-Americans in the North. So this happened fairly regularly. When I was writing Dark Work, The Business of Slavery in Rhode Island, I came across two such attacks just in Providence in, you know, less than a 15-year period. So as Black people were transitioning out of slavery into freedom, a process they themselves were driving, they were attacked.
Annalisa, you share the story in the piece the two of you wrote about one of these attacks in Cincinnati. Can you give us tell us a little bit about this so we get a sense of the scope of what we're talking about here.
Right. So there were actually three massive racist attacks in Cincinnati between 1829 and 1841. And this involved literally people, very highly organized whites, being organized by newspaper editors and politicians for weeks, if not months, in advance of these attacks. So they're really well organized. And in 1841, they broke into the federal armory, took out guns and a cannon, and literally started shooting the cannon into this African-American neighborhood. So we're talking about the destruction of buildings, homes, churches, schools, and lives.
Christy, Annalisa mentioned the involvement of political leaders, of members of Congress and others. Sometimes when we think of mob violence, we think of a spontaneous thing happening leaders come in and shut down. That was not the case here.
Absolutely not. These were, as historians say, gentlemen of property and standing. Right. So these are the social elite, the political elite, and the economic elite. These are mill owners and lawyers and politicians and church leaders that are often the impetus for these attacks on these rising Black communities that are being attacked because they're successful, because Black people were giving lie to the myth that slavery was the proper place for them, that they could not and would not thrive in freedom. And as they did thrive and succeed in freedom, they were attacked for that success.
And Annalisa, the brutality of the messages here and the attacks themselves, you quote leaders literally calling on white people to castrate Black men and rape Black women. This just unbelievable, but it happened.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. It did. And I think one of the really important things to remember is that when what we call the Great Migration occurred in the 20th century, African descended people were coming from the South into northern cities that were already segregated because of this violence that occurred before the Civil War. And if we erase this history of racist violence, we erase the people that it occurred against, right? This is about belonging. And for so long, there has been this really toxic myth in the Midwest and in the North that African Americans don't belong on those frontier and rural spaces, that they literally were not there before the Civil War or even in the 19th century. But not only were they were there in greater numbers and succeeding at a greater, like to a greater level than historians have acknowledged for years.
We continue our conversation with historians Christy Clark Pujara and Annalisa Cox. We're talking about a piece they wrote for the National Museum of American History, looking at mob violence against black communities in northern states before the Civil War, out east and here in the Midwest. Christy, Annalisa was talking about this being erased from history in many ways. And, you know, I paid attention in school. I voluntarily read history a fair amount on my own time. The stories you're telling, I read about yesterday when I read your piece for the first time, for the most part. Why, how did this get erased?
I think your experience is really common. And this erasure is intentional. Anyone can search the databases of the 19th century newspapers now and have been able to do so for a couple of decades, thanks to technology. And any just basic search of Northern newspapers will fill out all of this information. This is not like information that was tucked away in some great grandmother's attic and nobody had access to. We have chosen, and when I say we, I'm talking about historians, have chosen the stories that we tell. And for so long, we have told this really binary, simplistic story of a anti-slavery North and a pro-slavery South. And that has served to erase the tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of Black people that have been in the North since the 1620s. And we don't think about that. And even right here in Wisconsin, the history of Black people in this place that becomes Wisconsin is one that begins in the French territorial period in the 1720s. Yet we have no sense of that. When we think about the founding of Wisconsin, we don't think about the fact that our first territorial governor, Henry Dodge, brought 5 enslaved people with him to the territories in 1827. And they come 100 years after the first Black people are in the region. And so this history has been intentionally erased. And we tell a story that is much more in line with Little House on the Prairie than what actually happened in these spaces. And one really great thing about Annalisa's book, The Bone and the Sinew, something that I really appreciated as a historian, is that she reminds us that there was a state's worth, so 60,000 free Black people in the Midwest before the Civil War. And we know little to nothing about them outside of some of the incredible work that she's done.
Annalisa, I wanted to get into another piece of this story, the attacks we talked about against Black communities, the most dramatic part of the story, not the only part. In the piece the two of you wrote, you talk about things like voting and property and other restrictions on the lives of the Black people in the Midwest and the East that Christy was just talking about. Can you spell that out a little for us?
Right. So we often think of equal voting rights as something that came in the 20th century, but actually we went through an early equal rights and civil rights movement around the time of the American Revolution. So we're talking the late 1700s here in the United States, a revolutionary war that people of African descent took part in and fought in for the freedom of all people. They believed those words that all men are created equal with an equal right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so the Northwest Territory that becomes the states of Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, and Wisconsin start off in 1787 with the right to vote for any man who owns 50 acres of land. And that included men of African descent. And when Wisconsin becomes a state, the white people in Wisconsin steal that right to vote from the propertied pioneers of African descent who are in Wisconsin already.
And Christy, I want to pick up a little more of the Wisconsin story. As we mentioned, you're working on a book from slavery to suffrage in the Wisconsin territory, the main title, Black on the Midwestern Frontier. What other stories are you coming across, if you can give us a little a teaser for the book you're working on?
Absolutely. So to get to some specifics that Annalisa just mentioned about voting, Wisconsin was supposed to become a state in 1846. The first constitution failed. It failed for a number of reasons, but one of those reasons was there was a referendum attached to that first constitution that said there had to be an immediate vote on whether or not Black men would have access to the ballot box. That was controversial and one of the reasons why Wisconsin doesn't become a state in 1846. In 1848, the constitution that was passed that was that helped create the state of Wisconsin was explicitly racist. If you read the suffrage article of the 1848 constitution, it is crystal clear. In order to vote, you need to be white, you need to be male, you need to be 21. And whiteness is what was most important. Not even citizenship. So if you were a foreign-born white male and you had lived in the state or a territory or the territory for a year, you could just declare an intention to become a citizen and you had the right to vote. So the bar wasn't citizenship, the bar was whiteness. And then there's all of these other clauses that really restrict the vote for Native Americans, right? That there were some of them who could vote if they met a really high bar of already being a citizen of the United States. But what's important about that suffrage article, and I really encourage people to get a copy of the 1848 Constitution, you can read it online, the Wisconsin Historical Society has originals, right, is how important whiteness was. Because there wasn't like there was tens of thousands of Black people that were going to create some kind of voting bloc. There were actually very few Black people in the state. Less than we're talking about thousands of people. So if every last one of them had voted two or three times, they still wouldn't have constituted any kind of political voting bloc. But what's important was whiteness, because whiteness was seen as worthy settlement, as belonging, as what was necessary to contribute to the creation of that society.
In our last few moments, Annalisa, there's an ongoing debate coming up again in recent days over how to talk about one's own country's history. Are we celebrating the happier sides of heritage or paying attention to the worst moments? Can you talk about what we lose if we don't look at the bad stuff?
I want to be really clear here. I think that Christy would be in agreement with me here that I don't think of myself as looking at the quote unquote bad stuff. Mm-hmm. I think of myself as looking at the facts. We are just presenting the truth. I think something fundamental gets lost, both the sort of the painful and distressing aspects of America's past, as well as the good aspects, if we literally ignore the truth and ignore the facts of the past. And ignore entire populations. If we erase people of African descent from the Wisconsin frontier and from Wisconsin's history, we are erasing basic facts about why Wisconsin is the way it is today and how it even became a state.
Annalisa, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And Christy, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Christy Clark-Pujara, Associate Professor of History in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, and Annalisa Cox, Historian of Racism in 19th Century America. We've been talking about a piece they wrote for the American Museum, the National Museum of American History, on attitudes of race in the North before the Civil War.